Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Now, what Wells Fargo Bank did to earn what may be the highest fine in history, and what it means for banking as a whole. Reuters reported this week that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau may assess a fine against Wells Fargo of up to $1 billion. That's with a B. If the penalty is that high, it would be a record fine. The CFPB is also going after the agency that regulated Wells Fargo's practices day to day. Today, a discussion about the accusations against the bank and how they may inform a call for lighter regulation on the banking industry as a whole. I also want to talk about trust in banks. And by the way, we invited Wells Fargo to participate in the show, and they declined. So as our guests prepare to join us, I'd like to hear from you. If you're a customer of Wells Fargo, current or former, have these investigations and this potential fine influenced the way you do business with the bank? And for all of us, has the banking industry regained your trust in the wake of the financial meltdown of 2008? 2007, 2008, 2009. I'd like to hear from you on your trust of banks and whether, as a former or current customer of Wells Fargo, what you're thinking about these several years of allegations of different scandals within Wells Fargo. Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. On Twitter, at Carrie NPR, and I'll get to a lot of the Twitter comments here. If you want to reach me on Twitter, it's K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Our guest today, Stacey Cowley, is a journalist, and she writes about banking for the New York Times, and she's with us today from New York City. Stacey, welcome. It's really good to have you on the show.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
John Taylor is with us, president and CEO of the National Community Reinvestment Coalition, and he's with us today from Washington. John, welcome to you. It's good to have you on the show.
Glad to be here.
Stacey, if the $1 billion fine is indeed levied against Wells Fargo, is that primarily aimed at this mortgage and auto lending, alleged violations, or is it also about the fraudulent customer account practices, which I know you've reported on extensively?
Yeah, it would be over the auto and mortgage, since the agency we're talking about here, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, has already fully settled with Wells Fargo over the fake accounts. But I think it's fair to say that any fine they're going after on the mortgage and auto front is being influenced by the fact that there is still a lot of anger over the fake account issue.
Okay. And as you've said, Wells Fargo settled $100 million on the phony account scandal. Wasn't that the largest fine the CFPB had ever levied?
That was the largest in terms of an actual penalty. $100 million was purely what Wells Fargo paid as a penalty, and there was some additional remediation and refunds on top of that. The CFPB has done other larger amounts when you factor in the amount that banks have to refund and things like that. But in terms of a purely punitive penalty, $100 million was the largest.
So, John, may I ask you what you make of, and again, this is Reuters reporting this with sources,
sure,
but it has not occurred, what you make of right. this potential $1 billion fine against Wells Fargo?
Well, I think the fine has to be at a level, and it sounds like I don't know that it is a billion, but let's assume it is. It has to be at a level in which it tells the bank this is not going to be a cost of doing business where you simply put in your budget down the road that, you know, if we get a fine, we'll pay that. It has to be something that really discourages this kind of activity. And it sounds like that level of fine would absolutely do that.
So when you say it is not going to be the cost of doing business, what you're suggesting here is that sometimes banks that are ending up being pretty profitable say, we don't like to pay the fines, but if we have to pay the fines, we can make more money doing some of this stuff that might be a little shady and just go ahead and pay the fine. Is that what you're suggesting?
I am suggesting that because for the longest time, before we had the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, we really relied upon agencies that had a lot of responsibilities outside of protecting consumers that didn't do this sort of thing. The CFPB, Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, was an agency that finally was created in 2011 whose job it was is to look out for consumers first and foremost. And they've returned billions of dollars to consumers. Mm-hmm. So I think what happened is for the longest time, the practice of doing things that were unsavory pretty much went unchecked. And if something did come up because a consumer group or somebody raised the issue, there'd be a fine. But the fine was often, you know, something that was easy to absorb. I think the kind of money we're talking about now from the CFPB, really, like on the $1 billion, that would probably be treble damages for whatever was done in the auto loan industry. So it does have that impact of saying, well, we'll never do this again. And the fine, but, yeah, sorry.
Yeah, Stacey, go ahead.
Yeah. I was just going to say, over the years, the banks have become accustomed to just shelling out these large amounts of money and treating it as a cost of doing business. Cumulatively, Wells Fargo has already paid more than $10 billion in fines and refunds, not just over the fake accounts, but over mortgage violations, auto lending.
Wait, Stacey, will you say that again? I want to make sure I've got my head around that. How much?
Yeah, that's $10 billion over several years on a whole number of issues.
Wow.
That's right.
Let me grab a call here from John in Minneapolis. John, are you saying you work at Wells Fargo?
Yes, that's correct.
Tell me what you wanted to say about this.
Well, there's a lot of focus on investors and there's a lot of focus on customers. And I just wanted to voice that as employees, we're also affected. And I don't work on the front lines. I work in IT. Mm-hmm. And we are seeing... we're being affected in the form of compensation. Bonuses are maybe not what they could be. You know, raises aren't exceptional anymore. And the work we do is used to be focused on adding features and enhancements for the business. And these days, the work that we do is more driven by regulatory changes and changes that Wells Fargo is wanting to do to comply with.
Yeah, John, I hear you on this, on the employees are paying the price. Stacey, in your reporting, is that something that you're learning as well from the employees?
Yeah, the takeaway from the fake account scandal for me was really that in terms of customer harm, it was frustrating for customers, but they didn't lose a lot of money. I think the worst damage was to the employees. I heard from so many people who left Wells Fargo or were forced out of Wells Fargo because they couldn't comply or didn't feel right complying with these demands. And for people who are still at the bank, I think that's really where the worst toll has fallen is on the employees.
So John, what does
that included, by the way, the ex-CEO who they fired?
I was just going to ask you about this. Okay, so what does that tell us then? Who's taking the most heat? Where was the board during all this? Where were the top leaders at Wells Fargo? Are the people who should be taking some of the heat for this getting enough of it, in your view, John?
I think what happened with the consumer credit card, as Stacey pointed out, the folks who got those fake accounts were made whole. At that time, the biggest fine from the CFPB was leveled against Wells. They fired the division leader who ran the credit card and a number of employees who worked on that scheme. Mm-hmm. And then they fired the CEO, and three board members had to leave, and then they got the biggest fine in history from the CFPB. I would think that if that doesn't sort of forever in a day make sure that they don't do anything wrong in the credit card industry, nothing will. But I do want to point out, too, this is a systemic problem that has been allowed to take place because of the lack of consumer protection agency. So Stacey mentioned that Wells had received fines of up to $10 billion. It's true for all the big banks. Mm-hmm. Bank of America is over $16 billion in fines. JPMorgan Chase, $13 billion. Citibank, $7 billion. And those numbers are actually a little dated. It might even be higher than that. But the point is, these banks were pretty much allowed to sort of do what they wanted at all costs to make profits. And sometimes it wasn't necessarily intentionally malfeasant, but there was no checks and balances and no capability of any agency really, or commitment of any agency to really go in and look at what these banks are doing and their impact on consumers.
Until we
created this CFPB,
which is now under attack.
I sense,
John, you want to talk about the CFPB, and I know it has new leadership, and Mick Mulvaney was testifying on Capitol Hill. I will get to that. Promise you that. That's all right. Listeners on Twitter, when I ask about trusting banks overall and what their relationship is with Wells Fargo, a listener says, no, I took my money out of Wells Fargo because of their misdeeds and now bank at a local credit union. Another listener, nope, I use my local bank. I have nothing but positive experiences. Stacey, I wonder if you've been able to zero in on what this has been for customers of Wells Fargo. Have they and I better disclose here, I'm a customer of Wells Fargo and have banked with them for years. And every time I think this is the last straw, I then go through my head all the stuff that I would have to do to change my account. Am I, unfortunately, like so many other people, customers of Wells Fargo?
Pretty much. I mean, I have certainly heard anecdotal accounts of people leaving, but when you look at their overall churn numbers, it was down a little bit in the wake of the scandal, but they've been able to rebuild. And I do hear from an awful lot of people like you who've been there for a long time, kind of roll their eyes at what they're going through with the bank. But it's a big upheaval to change banks, and a lot of people have a lot of inertia around that.
Beth says on Twitter, I've banked at Wells Fargo and Norwest before the merger for 20 years, my entire adult life. I'm in the process of closing all of my accounts. My money will not support these unethical practices, which target customers as well as employees. I will also be telling them why to the phones to Tim in Golden Valley. Hey, Tim, thanks for waiting. What are you thinking about this?
No problem. Well, I think it's easy to vilify Wells Fargo, and it's warranted. But this is a systemic problem. I've had equally toxic encounters with U.S. Bank and with TrueStone Financial. And I finally found a bank, Sunrise Bank, where I'm not getting any of the runaround. And there seems to be some integrity and some really good customer service. But I'm telling you, my partner died. I'm in a gay relationship. He passed away. Before marriage was legal, U.S. Bank continued to hound me for repayment of his debt when, you know, as an individual, when you die, the debt goes with you.
Right.
It took a cease and desist letter from my attorney. And the same thing was true with TrueStone Financial, where I had to go to the Minnesota Attorney General's office to say cease and desist some of their bad business practices
what I hear you saying, and let me put this to John and Stacey, is, and John, actually, I think you said this a minute ago, it is not Wells Fargo only. A lot of the banks are paying fines. How are they thinking about, if they are at all, restoring the damage that has been done on customer service and this trust that seems to be missing?
Well, I actually think they have a lot of work to do on that score. There's these fines, these stories, they're anecdotes across the country of experiences people have had. And it's not just with the big banks, it's with other banks. But what's ironic about all this is, and my biggest concern in this conversation, is there are two problems with these banks, right? Mm-hmm. One is when they act in a malfeasant way in which they do abusive things, and that occurs in every bank. But the other side, which is more important to me, is what are these banks doing in the way of lending to low and moderate income, people of color, people who are trying to build wealth, you know, mortgages, small business lending. And the irony of ironies is there is no bank better than Wells Fargo in keeping their branches open, making small business loans to low and moderate income people and people of color, making mortgages, quality mortgages to low income people and people of color. And what I don't want to have happen is to lose that commitment, to have that not be as important because of all the negative publicity.
Okay.
I'd love to see other banks being measured on what their commitment is, their investment. The one side is quality of access. The other side is access at all.
So, John,
and that's really important in this
conversation. I want to be clear on what you just said. You said when it comes to making small business loans to people of color or people that are
low and moderate income,
Wells Fargo really performs on that level. Is that right?
Performs better than any large bank, and also on mortgages.
Yeah, but what do you make of this whole mortgage scandal where they're accused of making changes to mortgages of customers who were in bankruptcy? And while they would lower the interest rate, they'd come in and extend the loan, sometimes for decades, meaning these people would, you know, end up having to pay over and over again on this loan. That doesn't seem to comport with what you've just said.
Well, they're doing that, and they're doing prime loans and near-prime loans that are very sustainable. So it's not that those things aren't happening. They are. But in terms of the mass of the population and who goes into these banks, it's more likely that they'll get a mortgage from Wells Fargo than from the other banks. The second largest mortgage lender to LMI and people of color actually is Quicken Loans, which does a tremendous job. But there's not a bank that's in second place to Wells when it comes to making mortgages.
Stacey, go ahead.
Yeah, that goes right to the heart of the challenge of trying to regulate a bank about Wells Fargo. They're incredibly large and incredibly diversified, and they can do really good things on one side of the ledger and really bad things on the other. And I think the regulators are really struggling with balancing that. They don't necessarily want this bank to go out of business or to be smited into oblivion, but it's hard to get them to shape up.
Stacey, can I ask you about something about the details on this mortgage thing that we just talked about? I have the facts on this correct as we know them. If you're in bank, go ahead.
Yes, one of the challenges is there's several mortgage issues Wells Fargo's grappling with. That is one of them, about improperly handling the mortgage loans of people in bankruptcy. The other one that they're under fire on is charging people rate lock fees for extending rate locks when it turned out that the bank itself caused the delay that forced the extension.
Wow.
So they said in their last regulatory filing that they think they're going to have to pay up to $98 million in refunds to people who they may have improperly charged those fees.
Let me grab a call here from Beth in Minneapolis. Hi, Beth.
Hello.
You worked for Wells Fargo, is that right?
Yeah, I did. My division got sold right after the first round of conversation with Elizabeth Warren calling Stump a gutless leader.
But yeah. Okay. What do you want to say here?
Well, what I want to say is that the removal of the Glass-Steagall Act is why we're grappling with this issue. But like, we've given them too much power, we've given them too much control, and Trump rolled over like a dog to the banking industry as soon as he got into office. I want to know why John Stumpf hasn't been brought up on insider trading.
Okay. I'm also getting a tweet here from Kevin who says a fine of $1 billion is a rounding error to Wells Fargo with a fourth quarter profit of $6 billion. Dodd-Frank made the bigger banks bigger, truly too big to fail. That's something that I want to talk about. So we've had our Beth bring up Glass-Steagall, and we've also had Dodd-Frank brought up here. I have questions for both of our guests on that. To Jack in Minneapolis. Jack, how are you hearing this discussion?
Well, the thing that comes to my mind is that as long as, and it isn't just banks, it's any big institution, as long as they can write off fines on their taxes, it's less of an impact than it might be. But the real place to hit these organizations is not in their profits, but in their share value. If the government can say to them, you must issue an extra 10 million shares at market value and you're not allowed to buy any of them back for 5 years, then the shareholders will see their value go down and they will scream and they will demand changes in accountability.
John, what do you think of that idea?
Well, I think it's an incredibly brilliant idea. I mean, because this was the complaint, of course, around the tax bill, right? So all these corporations got all this windfall from this new tax bill from the Trump administration. And what a lot of them did is use those funds to buy back their own shares and boost the value of the shares they already had. So, you know, whatever stimulus gets these banks to really straighten up and fly right and do the right thing, I think it's a good thing. Whether that needs to be a permanent solution or whether, you know, it's a one-off kind of activity, you know, needs to be discussed and determined. But anything that gets these banks on the stand, look, they're going to be fines. They're going to be serious fines. Mm-hmm. There's going to be clawbacks on pensions. We're going to demand that you fire people. The more you do that, and I think the industry is beginning to realize, particularly with the, I know you, I keep mentioning the CFPB, But with the advent of the CFPB, which can do deeper dives into these institutions, I think they're realizing it's a new day, and you've got to change your practices, and you've got to give responsible, good credit to people.
So, Stacey, before we get to the CFPB, I want to mention that the U.S. Senate passed this bill last month that would rewrite part of Dodd-Frank legislation that was passed in the wake of the financial crisis. As I understand, part of what it does, it exempts small banks from some of the Dodd-Frank requirements. But it also raises the threshold at which banks would be subject to that oversight to $250 billion. How does that fit into what we're talking about today?
It's one that wouldn't really affect the larger banks, but it does make a significant difference for some of the smaller ones. One interesting aspect of that, as I was actually speaking with the former senator or former representative Barney Frank about it, who's one half of the Dodd-Frank Act, and he was okay with it. His take was, you know, it's been a few years. It's time to tweak with the edges of this. He was okay with the idea of loosening some of the strictures on some of the smaller banks.
I don't agree with that.
Yeah, go ahead.
I don't agree with that. And I'm from Boston, and Barney is somebody I've known for 40 years, and Elizabeth Warren is my senator. What that exemption did was exempted 85% of all the banks in the country from reporting additional detail that would allow folks to see whether they're discriminating, whether they're treating people fairly. And Stacey's right that it doesn't affect the big banks, so that's a good thing. But there's so many little banks, community banks and banks that are $250 billion and below, which is, as I said, 85% of the banks, that now can continue to hide behind a veil of secrecy because this data is not going to be available for newspapers and community advocates like myself and others to analyze whether people are fairly getting access and how they're being treated.
As a journalist, I'm on the side of more data as well.
This is a conversation about what happened with the banking industry, whether trust has been renewed in as customers of banks or in the banking industry as a whole, and individually what's going on with Wells Fargo, which of course is a bank that has a lot of branches and a headquarters here in the Twin Cities. Have these investigations and the potential fines influenced the way you're doing business with Wells Fargo? And for all of us, has the banking industry regained your trust? What are you concerned about, especially when you hear us talking about some of the details of this legislation? 651-227-6000 and on Twitter at Carrie NPR. Ann says, during the recession, when I was unemployed, my loan officer at Wells Fargo worked for months to push through my HARP application for a refinance. My experience with Wells Fargo positive. Wow, Stacey, I'm shocked that anybody got anything out of that that program that I know the president put through, never really fulfilled its promise, but it's good to hear.
Yeah, it was a very challenged program. But for those who did manage to help, it was very valuable.
Yeah. Nicholas says, when I finally got tired of Wells Fargo and their malarkey, I closed my accounts. The banker was more interested in what I was doing that weekend than why I was closing accounts I had had for over 15 years. Yes, I think the customer service is now they're trying to be your friend as much as your banker. So call here from Rob in Minneapolis. Hi, Rob. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. Yeah, well, I have a lot to say, but I'm just going to start. I worked at Wells Fargo all through the mortgage meltdown of 2008 and then about 3.5 years back here in Minnesota. That was out in California. I worked at Countrywide. I worked at Bank of America. And the whole thing about all these corporations are it's all sales. And basically, if you don't make your numbers, you're out. So they put a lot of pressure on the employees that way. For instance, I was an underwriter at Wells Fargo for appraisals. And they say, you know, it's a 40-hour-a-week job. And then they come and say, now you got to need 80 files, which meant like 7 days a week job. And so your quality of life just starts going out the door. And then if you don't do it, then you're out, basically, is the pressure. So you can't underwrite with a good ethical, basically down to reading maybe 50 to 80 pages of documents within a minute to 2 minutes to try to qualify someone. So it's a lot of pencil whipping, whatever you want to call it. But ultimately, you want to know where the top leaders were. Most of them were at the golf course, strip clubs, or in Vegas, with a getting concerts by Eagles or Cher, doing a private show during the give out of the bonuses. It's all about the bonuses at the top.
Rob, if I may, what you said about these the additional requirements on employees, Stacey, that seemed to come out about these these phony accounts, that the employees were put under ridiculous pressure, and that's part of what led to these practices.
And the bank talked about they fired about 5,000 people for creating fraudulent accounts. But I heard from hundreds and probably thousands of employees who got pushed out or left of their own accord because they couldn't keep up with these insane demands.
John, now getting to the CFPB here, because Eric says, what if those fines from Wells Fargo and the other banks had to be used to create processes for changing banks, just like you can port your phone number? That would be good for consumer and help those stuck in their bank's ecosystem. He's saying, so make a process, right, to make it much easier to change banks if you're not happy. Would that be a good way to spend part of that money?
I think it would. I mean, I think the first that it should be spent on is any consumers that have been harmed through any of these practices ought to be made whole. And then anything that promotes, you know, clean, positive, honest bank behavior across the board, I think is what is in the interest of all consumers. So I think it's a good idea.
Okay. Tell me why you're skeptical of what's going to happen with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau under Mick Mulvaney, given the fact that it's Mulvaney who's apparently negotiating this billion-dollar fine with Wells Fargo.
Right. And he's also the guy who dismissed the suits, the complaints that were filed with the CFPB against payday lenders. Payday lenders are the most expensive and probably the most usurious kind of financial entity out there as it comes to working class and working poor people. And they charge outrageous interest rates, and they're particularly aimed at people who don't have a lot of income. So there was a lot of complaints that occurred under the Obama administration, went into CFPB. Mulvaney comes in and basically dismisses those cases. So, you know, I don't know what's going on with them and Wells, but I do know that Wells continues to be the number one mortgage lender and small business lender to low and moderate income people and people of color. And my big concern, I think they've paid dearly and will continue to pay dearly. Their stock price is way down, so they've lost fortunes on top of these fines.
Mm-hmm.
What I don't want to lose is the commitment that they make in trying to serve underserved people. So if we can not just Wells, but you know, all these banks, if we can clean them up, have them know that this Consumer Protection Agency is going to look at them, is going to follow them around, dog them to make sure that they're not doing these malfeasant activities. But what we are also going to be looking for is, and with the bank regulators, they call them the prudential regulators, Federal Reserve, FDIC, and the OCC, to make sure that they're actually doing lending now. So it's not just stop doing the bad things, but let's do some good things. Stop closing branches all over rural America and all over inner cities. Stop ending products and services that people need. Let's focus on what actually needs to happen in a positive way.
I mean, in some ways, you're saying do more of what Wells Fargo does when they're doing well.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
Stacey, I wanted to ask you, from your reporting, how integral the CFPB has been in getting banks to fly right, as John puts it.
Oh, it's been a complete sea change. I mean,
really?
We're all expecting that to change a bit in the coming years, but
under
it was
Mulvaney?
Astonishing.
Yeah.
Yes.
Under I don't think anyone's optimistic that's the trend that will continue under Mulvaney. But in terms of consumer advocates describing the effects that they've seen, I mean, people who've worked in this space for 20, 30 years said it was like nothing, you know, compared to this. The last 5-6 years when the CFPB was really starting to push people, especially because they were very aggressive and they were pushing people to sort of comply with the spirit of the law, not just the fine print of it. And so you did see a real impact on industries like payday lending and things like that, where people saw the enforcement actions they were taking and sort of got spooked into line.
Is there anything, John, that average voters can do to put pressure on the CFPB? And again, let's wait and see what Mulvaney's leadership is like. But if this is something you really care about, can you put pressure on the CFPB to continue that work?
I think it's pressure on the administration. And the real pressure for voters is, and I'll just say it, if you know, there's one party that looks out for the interest of the banks, notwithstanding Mulvaney and his complaint against Wells Fargo, and then there's another party that looks out for the protection of consumers. That Consumer Financial Protection Bureau was driven by Democrats. And it's just hard to imagine, and for people to imagine, prior to 2011, there wasn't a consumer agency you could go to to complain about these sorts of things. You had to sue these big banks, often ones that had arbitration agreements.
As an individual.
So it was so difficult. Yeah. And it's just so difficult. And you could file the complaint with the Department of Justice, but unless it was a huge case, you know, because they're drinking through a fire hose, you know, there was just not that place to go where you could just say, look, this bank treated me bad. Like a lot of the stories you heard from people who called in, they can call, and many of them did, call the CFPB, and I think they resulted in $11 billion from the CFPB at a very short period of time being returned to consumers. And now what you're seeing is a weakening of that. They want to change the charter to make it like commission. They want to remove its budget. They've taken the fair lending civil rights part of CFPB and basically defunded it practically. I mean, it's been pushed to the background. It's awful. And I'd like to give a different answer than say go out and vote. But until you have elected officials who care first about the interests of consumers and secondly about banks, then we're not going to have this is not going to change.
Jeff,
the other thing people can do.
Yeah, oh, Stacey, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, reaching out to your state attorney general is another key thing people can do, because the expectation is that as the federal regulators step back, the states are going to have to play more of a role on the consumer protection front.
Good to know. Right. Jeff on Twitter here has tweeted out a link. He says, here are a couple of great Planet Money segments on Wells Fargo's business tactics with their customers and their employees. I retweeted that, so follow that link and you can listen to Planet Money, which is a great program. To Kyle in Bloomington. Hi, Kyle. What's your question on this?
I didn't expect to get on.
I'm glad you did.
I'm curious if there's any data out there regarding generational changes. As a millennial, I've only banked with credit unions, and I don't see that changing in the near future.
Mm-hmm. This is such a good question.
I'm curious to see if there's been studies about what the changed with banking.
Stacey, you know anything about this?
Yeah, there's certainly studies out there that indicate that millennials are more interested in socially responsible financial options. We're waiting to see if that's going to have any systemic effect. I don't think there's been anything that's shown that it's really changed the system yet, but absolutely people are looking for a wider range of options and are much more focused on what the institutions that they're investing in and spending their money with are out there doing in their communities.
John, is that where your hope is invested in also, the wave of millennials who aren't going to put up with this nonsense from banks?
I hope a lot for the millennials. I'm hoping they're going to get back into the mortgage market and start buying houses and things like that. They'll help the economy. But this presumption that credit unions are better, credit unions do not have, they're not covered by certain laws like the Community Reinvestment Act. They don't pay taxes, so essentially they're tax-free entities when it comes to corporate taxes. And yet, if you look at studies that have been done and compare them to banks, similarly sized banks, it's not like they're outperforming banks in lending to low-income people and minorities. Some are, some aren't. But there's a presumption, particularly because they were created just for that purpose. But I've testified on this and done quite a bit of looking into this. And I'm a member of a bank and a credit union, so my wife and I debate this all the time. But I will tell you, the distinction between them is not as great as people think.
Wow, you're really striking at a sacred cow here, John. Every time I talk about banking, people are like, the answer, the holy grail, it's credit unions. So this is really good information to have. Yeah. Stacey, reporting on credit unions, want to add anything to this?
Just echoing that they sometimes get a halo that is not deserved universally across the board. So I think if people are looking at that, look really closely at the individual institution you're looking at. Many are fabulous. It really does come down to the individual institution.
Okay, good to know. To Ron in Minneapolis. Hi, Ron. What are you thinking about?
Hi, Gary. This is the gentleman that asked you if you read all those books one night at the...
yes, I do. Ron, if you must know, I read everything cover to cover. Okay.
Yeah, no. My thought is that these people have committed fraud. There are no criminal investigations, and there have been no prosecutions. And until that occurs, you will not change the greed factor in these banking institutions and at the board level.
I wonder what John and Stacey think of this.
Well, I would love to.
I just want to
go ahead, Stacey.
There are still criminal investigations going. We haven't seen any charges come out of them yet, but there are still several active criminal investigations into what's going on at Wells. The Department of Justice has one. A couple of cities have them going.
Are they hard cases to make, Stacey, when you're going after someone individually on criminal charges?
Yeah. I think that's why this has taken so long, as these are complicated cases.
John, what'd you want to say?
I think this Ron in Minneapolis has a very good point. And I want to use the example of HSBC. So HSBC was the bank for the drug cartel from El Chapo. I'm sure people, listeners know that name.
Yep.
They literally laundered as well as transferred funds from Mexico for the cartel, to the point where it was just almost $800 billion alone of drug money here in the United States that got deposited in their bank.
Wow.
And the Obama administration did, in fact, fine them a considerable amount of money, but probably, you know, a percentage of what they made in a given month, and then pushed down the line the criminal investigations. And when the Trump administration came in, and this past December, just a few months ago, they dropped those criminal investigations, and it made me think, like, well, if you can be the bank of the drug cartel, you know, the Sinaloa Mexican drug cartel, El Chapo's drug cartel, if you can be their bank, even in Mexico, there's all these people who were testifying that, you know, drug dealers would, you know, hey, I've made all this money. This is in Mexico. Where do I put this? Oh, go to HSBC in Mexico. It was the bank, and if we can't prosecute those people, the people who and of course our opioid epidemic, most of that drug comes from Mexico. If we can't go after them and make them pay for this, we're not going to go after
any of
the big banks.
Right?
Exactly.
I hear you. I'm going to leave you both, since we talked about the CFPB here, from Mick Mulvaney in opening testimony to the Senate Committee on Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs. While I have to be here by statute, I don't think I have to answer your questions. If you take a look at the actual statute that requires me to be here.
Oh, God.
Now you know. Now you want to know why John's a little concerned. John, really good to have you on the show. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much.
Stacey, great to have the benefit of your experience and your reporting. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stacey Cowley is a New York Times reporter. She covers consumer finance, and John Taylor is president and CEO of the National Community Reinvestment Coalition. Hey, coming up at 11 o'clock, Nancy Cassatt, our executive director for news and programming, is in the house and in the studio and answering your questions about why we cover the news the way we do. If you're a member, we'll take your... No, I'm just kidding. No, not nothing like that. Just call in 651-227-6000. Looking forward to having to hear what you ask.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at @KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.